Good morning and welcome to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. It's the weekly program about health, fitness, nutrition, and all things lifestyle. Well, Lynn Ware Peak is still touring Italy and having a great time, so we've got a couple more recorded interviews that we did before she left. First, we talk with Margot Bergen about her book, Navigating Life, Things I Wish My Mother Had Told Me. It's a book she wrote as a guide for her daughter and presented it to her on her first day of college. Then Dr. Robin Chutkin gives us a gut check with her book, The Microbiome Solution, a radical new way to heal your body from the inside out. This is The Mountain Life. Stay with us. We'll be right back after these words from our sponsors.
Hi, I'm Amy Roberts with Park City Hospital. We're part of the not-for-profit Intermountain Healthcare System and proudly support KPCW. Park City Hospital is one of the premier hospitals for orthopedic surgery and follow-up care. Whether you need your hip, hand, knee, shoulder, ankle, or elbow fixed, our team of skilled orthopedic surgeons can put you back together, and our physical therapists can help you regain your strength and get you back to your active lifestyle. You can learn more about all the PT services offered at parkcityhospital.org or by calling 435-658-7350.
Proudly supporting KPCW, Cushman & Wakefield Commerce offers commercial real estate services, including property management and valuation, for companies and investors throughout the Intermountain West. Located at Kimball Junction in the Park City Tech Center, we can be reached at 435-575-5600 or online at comre.com.
Well, Margot Bergen has spent 20 years raising three children and often found herself wishing there had been greater and better information conveyed to her to help her to be the best parent she could be by her parents. So she decided to take matters into her own hands and wrote Navigating Life, Things I Wish My Mother Had Told Me. She then presented her work to her daughter as her daughter headed off to college and is hopeful it will be useful as a guide and means to ground, not only for her daughter, but for many others who wish for the same assistance. Margot Bergen, welcome to The Mountain Life. Well, Margot Bergen has spent 20 years raising...
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here with you.
Well, this is such a pertinent book. Last week, this week, next week, many kids leaving town and going off to college, whether it's close or far away, and reading your book, it just... You're at this point of parenting where you go, oh, did I teach you everything? And here you go out the door. And so no doubt, we'll talk about why you wrote this book.
Well, I think there were a number of reasons. And it started off with when Charlotte was 9 years old and I woke up in the middle of the night and thought, oh, my goodness, what am I going to do with all of these different dramatic events that are happening all at once? And that really was the catalyst to sit down and start writing in note form, really, to her, how to survive life. And when I talk about surviving, it was sort of a combination of job loss and divorce and depression and death and addiction. And some of the big ticket items that happen in life happen sort of all at once. And that's why I thought, well, maybe I could show her how to survive all of this if I could write it down. And then over the decade of writing, it turned into something perhaps a little bit more positive, which is once my life stabilized, how I could move from surviving into thriving. And then kind of working life out on the page over 10 years by looking at all kinds of big issues, which then resulted in the book that I gave her in manuscript form the day she went off to college.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, do you find that we as parents are so busy with the day-to-day things, you know, did you get your homework done, you know, that sort of thing, that we maybe overlook those, like you say, the big ticket items or the big picture things? We're just managing day-to-day. That's what I think parents, when their kids get to the age that Charlotte was when you gave her the manuscript, they go, oh, wait. And you, and how, I don't know. It's amazing you had the foresight to write those things down.
Well, I think, you know, I absolutely agree. I think, you know, I was so kind of caught up in the weeds of everything, which is just sort of getting food on the table and making sure that they actually went to school with clothes on. That we do get caught up in that. And I think for me, the catalyst really was that I felt I wasn't really doing life very well and therefore probably needed to kind of sit down and take stock. And the way that I'd always dealt with that was writing, essentially. So you know, it forced me to look at life in a very kind of hard way that I hadn't really expected to kind of take that pause at all. I just sort of thought I'd sort of just keep going and put my head down and see if I could, you know, write the check for the mortgage and put food on the table. And I think all parents, and, you know, many of us in life are just, you know, working at a quite sort of, you know, a very fast pace, essentially. And I think, you know, I was lucky enough that some of this trauma and tragedy forced me to take stock.
And Margot, when you were taking stock, I'm curious, was it a form, as you said, you know, you've always dealt with issues in your life through writing. So was this kind of an expanded version of journaling, or did it even start off as journaling? And then were you journaling as a parent, or were you journaling with some form of expertise around these issues of parenting and childhood development and depression and the various things that you talk about in your book?
Well, I had always sort of jotted down notes, I realized, looking back on it, my whole life. It wasn't sort of a formal diary process, but whenever I had to work something out, I always found it easier to write it than to speak it. And I think that I had no expertise at all. I just thought, I've put myself in a position where I am a parent, so how can I do this better? So it was really the sort of the amateur mother who was coming to the page thinking, maybe I now need to look at, you know, how to hold a conversation or to talk about how I deal with fear or to reckon with my boss at work. So very, very much not an expert, but I think quite willing to ask myself questions about almost everything in my life.
And I'm wondering about that aspect of your nature, that you were open and willing to do inquiry and sort of what you might call personal work. And then you've shared that personal work in the form of a guide, which is navigating life for parents and for children. Do you think there was something special or unique about you, or do you think that most parents would have the ability to do that if they were properly motivated or inspired?
There's nothing special or unique about me at all. I think what happened was that I just saw trauma and tragedy and failure and thought, I'm not going to go under. I need to do something. So it was that, I suppose, the fear of going under that put me to work on the page in some ways. So maybe I'm just better dealing with adversity than I had thought. But honestly, I'm just, you know, a single parent of three kids who is trying to find her way and just got up out of bed and just started to write out of real desperation, I think.
So you divide your book into a couple different topics: navigating relationships, family, life's up and downs, and work. So give us some ideas about navigating work for that kid who's going off into adulthood.
Work, I think, is a really, really interesting laboratory in which to spend some time. One of the things that I have told my children and also tell myself is that, in particular, when you are going into the work world, just to remember that your boss, this amazing person who's given you perhaps your first job, they really want you to succeed and that they are, too, a real person. And bosses are so easy to sort of to be people we kind of feel are perhaps getting at us or don't understand us. But I think, you know, learning how to manage up to them, learning how to ask for the right kind of instruction, bringing a great inclination to work, I think that's, you know, really key. People sort of smell how you are. You know, we communicate in nonverbal ways. And I think if you go in with just a really good attitude, it makes work so much easier. And the other thing I would say about work is mostly a funny line that I got from a friend, which is, your emergency is not my crisis.
Yeah.
So in terms of preparing yourself and actually not leaving things to the last minute so that your colleague has to pick up the pieces. But, you know, work can be enormously fun and it can be enormously frustrating. And I think it really depends on your attitude when you start in the work world, how you get on.
Yeah. It's interesting, young people going into the work world, whether they're having their first, you know, internship or their first job, it seems a fine balance also between how to advocate for yourself and ask for what you need and how to be an underling at the same time. What do you say about things like that?
I think it is the most difficult balancing act that a young person will have. And my older daughter, Charlotte, to whom the book is written, she and I have spoken about that a lot. She came up against negotiating a pay raise and a promotion, and we were talking about how to do that in a respectful but clear manner and to make it less personal. But also knowing that, you know, you use the word underling. I mean, there really is a hierarchy at work, and being respectful of those sort of historic the historic structures that come when, you know, you're 25 and your boss is 48, that in fact, you know, they are your boss for a reason, and sort of having to recognize, to accommodate to the reality that is the workplace without losing your voice, and knowing how to negotiate in a clear and transparent way. But you're right, it's hard, it can be done, but it has to be done thoughtfully.
And Margot, looking at those sort of sections that you've broken the book down into, work, relationship, and family, I can't help but notice that there's a great deal of overlap between them. And so it must have been interesting from your perspective to be able to distill those into separate categories. But you talked about balance, and I'm thinking about balance in family and what, you know, knowing what to share with your child and what to hold back from your child, because we all have, at least people of my age, we sort of have these experiences that we went through when we were in high school that were always a little reticent to share with our kids because the context was so different back then. And things that I did, or you could say got away with, they didn't have life-altering consequences the way that they do today. And so in relationship and in those family dynamics, you have to walk a fine line of what to share and what not to share.
You do. And it's a question that I've spent a lot of time thinking about, particularly with my group of friends who are parents. You know, I started writing the book for Charlotte when she was 9, and I wrote it in real time. So there were things that a 9-year-old could not possibly, that I shouldn't share with a 9-year-old, that I could more readily share with an 18-year-old on her way to college. And I really had to think long and hard what to put down on the page, but I wanted to show her some of my own struggles around, in particular, relationships. I was divorced from her father, so for me that seemed like a good context to explain about the failure of my marriage and what I had sought to do to sort of mitigate that. And also, you know, to address issues that she was very well aware of, which was, you know, my father's alcoholism and my own depression, things that she had already been exposed to, which I thought were better contextualized by my words than for her to hear about it from somebody else. So again, with each parent-child relationship, I do think it depends on the age of the child, their maturity and their development, but also, you know, what they have already been exposed to and in some ways expect to hear from us.
Something that is kind of just occurring to me is I would like to ask, what's the intent of your book? Because, you know, I went through a process with one of my children, and one of the things that I learned that was on a wall of a room, it was some adage about how every parent fails their children because it's impossible not to, basically. You know, we try and we do the best we can, but you can't address all the needs of your child. That's an impossible task. So by definition, you are going to fail your children in some way or another. So I always look at any guide that is presented as a guide to, you know, successfully navigating life. You know, there are paths and there are courses and there are ways to navigate, but there's no sure bet, right? I mean, and I know that your book isn't claiming to be a sure bet, but what is the intention?
The intention was to give her a way of thinking about how to approach life. Really, that was what it was.
So it's a way to ground her or create an organizing principle?
I think a way to think about life and a way to potentially organize her life. You know, these are suggestions, not strictures. And I think being able to mirror her path from 9 to 18 to remind her of where she came from and who she was, and also to give her somewhat of a framework to think about adopting. So, you know, what I found now that she's read the book a few times is that what this has given her is, in some ways, an ability to have a conversation with me and with others about what some people would consider unconscionable topics. So I think, you know, I was trying to fill in the gaps for things that my mother was unable to teach me or tell me. And I'm trying to do the same thing with her. And, you know, my attitude is if I get 70% of this right, I think that, you know, that may be a very good thing. But you're right. We will always fail our children because we simply can't know everything they will come up against, but we can help prepare them a little bit.
That's right. So on navigating relationships, for example, and this is something we try to teach our kids throughout their lives, but when to turn your back on friends that are unhealthy for you or create toxic relationships. And I, you know, talk a little bit about that and how it goes into romantic relationships.
Well, I think where the sort of common denominator is between, you know, friendships and romantic relationships is really understanding yourself and having a much better sense of what your values are. And I think then you can decide when you're in a friendship with somebody, you're much better equipped to be able to look at, you know, the friendship in a way that tells you, do they support your values? Are you able to support their values? And is there a sense between you that this is something that's really, really positive? And then I think you can sort of extend that thinking into the romantic realm too, which is, you know, essentially, as I say in the book, the most important relationship you have with is with yourself. And so knowing yourself and what you stand for allows you to make, I think, a better choice of partner.
Yeah, that's good. On navigating life's ups and downs, you know, I think for some time now in the age of helicopter parenting, we are trying to save our children from failure or from mistakes or from pain. And your approach, of course, is one that teaches them there will be pain and there will be difficulty. Here's how to be resilient.
Yeah, I mean, I really puzzled over this one a huge amount because I think our instinct is to protect them from the reality of life. But as I said at the beginning of the book, this book was really to prepare her, not to protect her from life, and sort of helping her think through how do you actually build resilience and how do we, in a sense, as parents, get out of their way at certain junctures so they do learn to actually feel the pain of their mistakes. That's very, very, very hard. It's something that I determined to do quite early on. And it still causes me a little bit of shock when, you know, I can't bail them out because they've lost X or they have spent all their money. I just don't do that. I don't have the resources. But I also think that the feeling through the result of their mistakes and failure is the thing that will prevent them from doing it again.
And Margot, I'm curious as to who would you like to have read this book? Is it Charlotte's peers or is it Margot's peers or some combination of those groups?
I would like everybody to read this book because what I'd like is for us to have a conversation that allows us to communicate more directly with each other and to engage more fully in what we're all trying to do, which is to live reasonably good lives in service of others.
Yeah, it's great stuff. I'm so glad I found it at this point of my child going off to college. And I appreciate your efforts here. Margot Bergen, thanks for joining us on The Mountain Life. The book is Navigating Life, Things I Wish My Mother Had Told Me. Thanks so much, Margot.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Bye.
You're listening to The Mountain Life. We'll be right back after these words from our sponsors.
This is Beth Lohman from Park City Mountain and KPCW supporter. Epic Promise grants focus on youth programs and environmental initiatives that impact our communities. Grants fund programs that help kids achieve great things in the classroom and develop a passion for the outdoors by engaging guests, local communities, and employees. Information at epicpromise.com.
Hi, I'm Matt from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of contemporary and mountain modern home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake and offer complete design services. We are on the web at sanfrandesign.com. San Francisco Design, love your home.
This is Danny Warner, owner of Chateau Recovery, and proud to sponsor The Mountain Life on KPCW. Chateau Recovery, helping adults with substance abuse issues build a new life through acceptance, perspective, and empowerment. Information available at 866-808-4160 or chateaurecovery.com. Addiction is a disease. Recovery is a choice.
Dr. Robin Chutkan is one of the most recognizable gastroenterologists working in the United States today. Dr. Chutkan considers both the art and science of medicine equally essential to achieving a healthy and balanced mind and body. Her primarily plant-based diet, vinyasa yoga practice, and long-distance running are the foundation of her own healthy regime, and she strives to highlight the importance of nutrition, exercise, and leisure to her patients as well. She joins us to discuss her new book, The Microbiome Solution. Dr. Chutkan, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you so much for having me.
So let's set the stage here to present the assertion or the research that proves that every serious disease or chronic ailment begins in our gut. And this is all about the microbiome. Why don't you first define what the microbiome is?
I'd be happy to. The microbiome refers to all the microbes that live in and on the human body, mostly in the GI tract, about 100 trillion in all, and more than a billion microbes in just one drop of fluid in your colon alone. So we're talking about a lot of organisms.
Okay, so we have heard this recently in a lot of literature and research that it's all about the gut health. It's all about the gut health. So we know a few places that our gut health has gone wrong and gone bad, but take us back to a time when our gut health was perfect. Was there ever such a time? And were we more well? Were we healthier?
And did we look different? And were we thinner?
Yes. I think all yes to all of those things.
And so could we still drink wine?
Probably wine, yes, but beer, no, is the answer. So if we go back not too far, but maybe just a couple hundred years, we lived in peaceful coexistence with our microbes. We weren't in this sort of all-out war against them. And in fact, a lot of the things that we think of as bad now, like parasites and so on, actually helped our gut because they helped to dampen down our immune system so they didn't overreact to things. So there's a really fascinating hypothesis called the hygiene hypothesis. And this was David Strawn, who was a professor of the London School of Tropical Medicine and Hygiene, was tasked in the 1950s with trying to figure out why they were seeing skyrocketing rates of eczema and hay fever in children in post-industrial London. So remember, everybody had left the farm for the factory right around that time. And he embarked on a study with thousands of children, took about 26 years, and he made two startling observations. The first was that children from large families who had a lot of siblings who were constantly infecting them, sneezing on them, coughing on them, they had low rates of hay fever and eczema. And the other observation was that children from more affluent households where they had higher standards of hygiene had higher rates of hay fever and eczema. And so this turned everything that we thought we knew about cleanliness and health and so on its head, and it suggested that it was actually better to be a little bit dirty, to be, you know, not have access to you know, lots of showers and baths and to have a lot of runny-nosed donors who are infecting you all the time. And if we look at a map of the world today and we look at the developed world or the more developed world, at North America and Western Europe, we see high rates of autoimmune diseases, diseases like Crohn's and colitis and MS and lupus, diabetes, and very low rates in sub-Saharan Africa and Southeast Asia. And as countries become more industrialized, we've seen this a lot in India and the Middle East, we start to see the rates of these post-industrial diseases increase.
So, Robin, I'm curious, because you said that, you know, some of these studies have suggested that this might be the case. And you know, I'm wondering where we are in that process of either having something that's a suggestion and there's strong evidence to support versus a accepted new medical paradigm. And there seems to be around the health of the gut and the microbiome this ebb and flow. And maybe it's just because I've become familiar with it or paying attention to it in the last, you know, brief period of time. But it doesn't seem like it ever really gets concretely accepted in the medical community. And there's always debate and discussion and an additional study that is contradictory to the last one.
Yeah. Well, you know, Tim, you raise a really good point. And part of it is because these diseases are complex and they're multifactorial, just as they're not purely genetic. So if you take a disease, one of the two I treat, Crohn's and ulcerative colitis, you take Crohn's disease, it's what we consider a familial disease. It's not strictly genetic. About 25% of people have a family history, but 75% of people don't. And the first genes for Crohn's disease were described about 15 years ago. The first one was a NOD2 gene on chromosome 16. And since then, there have been about 100 other genetic areas that are associated with having the disease. And most of these genes, how they're expressed is that the body overreacts to normal gut bacteria. But you can have many, many genes for Crohn's disease. Without an environmental trigger, you'll probably never develop the disease. So it's this complex interplay between the environment, the genes, the microbiome, and that's part of the ebb and flow that you see. There's some recent articles suggesting that alterations in the microbiome may be associated with Parkinson's disease, but we know there's also a genetic component to Parkinson's disease. We know there are environmental risk factors for Parkinson's disease, and the disease is different in different people. If we look at a disease like Crohn's, again, the one I'm most familiar with, we see a percentage of people who have a strong family history for Crohn's and seem to have a more genetic type. We see people who have post-infectious Crohn's, who go on spring break to Mexico or Southeast Asia and get dysentery and come back, and then lo and behold, 6 months later, they have Crohn's. We see people who seem to develop Crohn's after exposure to certain medications. So it is we're kind of lumping lots of different diseases together, often under one umbrella. And even when we are talking about one specific disease, there are multiple ways that disease gets expressed. And that makes it a little bit tricky. If we look at something like colon cancer, there's now evidence that the microbiome, that colon cancers have a particular microbial signature, if you will. But there's also data that cutting down your meat intake can decrease the risk of colon cancer. There are also genetic forms of colon cancer. They're all connected, of course, because microbes can affect gene expression. They can determine which genes are turned on and off. And, of course, the food you eat determines the microbes you grow. You know, I think you look at something as complex as illness and health, and sometimes I think it all boils down to these three simple words: eat more plants is sort of where it's at. But you're absolutely right about the ebb and flow, and that's because in some cases it's a contributing factor. It's a risk factor, but it doesn't completely explain how we get there.
So if we're focusing in on how genes express themselves and there's an environmental context to that, and the environmental context has changed, as you pointed out, over the last 200 years dramatically, what are we to do today when we aren't exposed to as much environmental, contaminants that would actually benefit our autoimmune system? And I know your book gets into this, so it's kind of a guide in today's new reality, what we can do to affect how our genetics express themselves.
So I would sum it up as more bugs, fewer drugs, number one. I mean, the ripple effect of a lot of the pharmaceuticals that we're exposed to, as well as the herbicides, the pesticides, and so on, the things in our environment can affect gene expression dramatically, and we've seen that. A lot of these things are endocrine disruptors and so on. But we also need more exposure to healthy microbes out in nature. We sort of live in these hermetically sealed environments, and we need to really rethink that. We need to rethink how and where our food is grown. Ideally, it's grown in soil, so we have the advantage of ammonia-oxidizing microbes that are in soil as opposed to food that's assembled in factories. Getting a pet is a great idea. Dogs bring in a lot of healthy microbes. The studies show that kids who grow up with dogs have lower rates of allergy and asthma. So we need to think about all of these things, our personal care products, the cleaning products we use in our home, where and how our food is grown, what we're eating, the fiber content, our medicine cabinet. That's a huge source of microbial disruption, not just antibiotics, which I think most people are aware of, but some of the commonly used drugs like nonsteroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, acid-suppressing drugs, birth control pills, hormone replacements, steroids, these all have a profound effect on our microbiome. So I think trying to lighten up the pharmaceutical load is very helpful, both in terms of gene expression and the health of our microbiome, and trying to sort of eat more food from nature. I mean, it sounds a little basic and not very scientific, but I think it's still very good advice.
And, you know, you just hit on a whole plethora and list of things that I was actually going to ask you about, because here in Park City, we don't believe that we're hermetically sealed. We're exposed to a lot of wonderful outdoor environment. We spend a great deal of time outside getting dirty. And then we also, there seems to be a very high focus on eating the way that you recommend that we eat. You know, there's a great deal of consciousness around raw food, good food, whole food, and locally grown and sourced food. But at the same time, things that would never even occur, I don't think, to many of us, things like the chlorination of our water, which does happen. We chlorinate our water in this community. We filter it, and then we hit it with chlorine. And that's one of those things that you in your list would be in your list.
Absolutely. And, you know, I've had the pleasure of spending time in Park City, and you're right. You guys are way ahead of the curve in terms of a lot of things you're doing. But some of the things, you know, you're dealing with a large municipal water supply. You have to chlorinate it. And chlorination has helped to stave off things like cholera, waterborne illnesses that were endemic in decades past in the U.S. But it comes at a price, because it means that it also kills off many of the healthy microbes that are in the water supply. And the chlorine also, when it hits you, whether it's your scalp, your skin, you're ingesting it, it means it's killing off a lot of those healthy microbes too. There are some things you can do. There are some whole house chlorine filters. You can put a charcoal filter in your shower head. You know, there are little things that you can do, but some of these things are really just a fallout from living in more urban environments. And, you know, what's really fascinating is studies have shown that as the amount of glass and concrete in a neighborhood goes up, as landscapes become more urbanized, the bacteria on our skin changes dramatically and not for the better. I don't think they've done the study looking at the internal microbiome in the gut, but certainly the amount of staph and some of the not-so-great species on the skin really changes. And we know that the rates of asthma go up in urban areas. So one of the simple things that you can do is just, you know, even if you are in a big city, is get out into nature, sit in the grass, try not to sit right on the dog poo, but in close proximity, and, you know, breathe in some fresh air, open a window, get some plants into your house. And if you're in Park City, get out into the mountains.
If you're just joining us, our guest is Dr. Robin Chutkin. She's the author of the book, The Microbiome Solution, A Radical New Way to Heal Your Body from the Inside Out. And a bit ago, Dr. Chutkin, you mentioned antibiotics, and you said, by this point, most of us know that we destroy the good flora in our gut when we take antibiotics. Well, that said, most of us do know that, but also, I was thinking about in both of my children's lifetimes and in my lifetime, any time we've had the unfortunate circumstance, and we do avoid it, of being prescribed antibiotics, I have never once had a doctor say, oh, hey, you're going to destroy some of the healthy flora in your gut, so you should do these things. You know, never once. And so I find that disconcerting. I find it like, are we in this disparate belief about what it does to what the antibiotics do to your gut, and how do we remedy that?
Well, we're in this peculiar time in medicine where a lot of consumers, and I'm sure savvy consumers like you, actually know more than a lot of people in the medical community. And I think that's definitely the case. I see very sophisticated patients in my medical practice who know, I think, a lot more than many of my medical colleagues. So part of the reason you're not getting that information is because physicians don't know it. And part of the sad reality is that much of our medical education comes from pharmaceutical companies who have a very vested interest in us prescribing lots and lots and lots of medications. So the startling statistic is that 5 days of a broad-spectrum antibiotic, as you know, removes about a third of your gut bacteria, and it can take years for that to come back. And when it does come back, it's often with sort of missing microbes in a very patchy way. A probiotic can help, but I think it's very important for people to realize that a probiotic does not reverse the damage an antibiotic does. The analogy I use in the book is that taking an antibiotic is like draining all the water out of a bath, and taking a probiotic is like filling a cup full of water and putting it back in. So number one, two, and three on the list is avoid antibiotics whenever possible. And you really have to kind of be that parent with your kids at the doctor to say, well, does my kid have to take this? What would happen if they didn't take it? Is there anything else they could do? What's the worst thing that can happen if we didn't take this antibiotic? Because the studies in the pediatric literature show that pediatricians prescribe antibiotics about 62% of the time when they think a parent expects it, and about 7% of the time when they think they don't. That's an incredibly broad gray area. A lot of the time, most of these air infections and pharyngitis and colds are viral. Antibiotics don't have any efficacy, and what they're trying to do is they're trying to placate a worried parent. That was fine a decade or so ago when we thought somehow, magically, that these antibiotics didn't have any downside. Now we know they have a tremendous downside, not just to the individual who's taking them, but to society with the emergence of resistant superbugs.
Right.
So we as consumers have to be savvier, and we have to really push our physicians to change our prescribing habits.
Yeah. Well, in the case, actually, my 18-year-old son had a small surgery a couple of weeks ago, and because there was risk of infection, they prescribed antibiotics, and I didn't even question it. In that case, he took a little bit of probiotics afterwards, and then a few days ago, he was struck with the flu. And it just makes me think that there's a big connection there.
Oh, sure. It could have increased the susceptibility. But, you know, there's a risk of infection with everything. There's a risk of infection when you brush your teeth, quite frankly. But the risk of infection is much lower for most surgical procedures than the risk of the harm of the antibiotic.
Mm.
Your son got the flu, but lots of times it's Clostridium difficile infection, C. diff, which we know causes about 20,000 deaths a year in the U.S. And the main risk factor for getting C. diff is taking an antibiotic. So, you know,
wow.
This sort of narrow way of looking at it, that I'm going to make sure my patient doesn't get an infection and I don't care what happens to them outside of that. We can't practice medicine that way anymore. And for most of these things, the risk of the harm of the antibiotic really outweighs the risk that you're going to get an active infection.
Oh, that's so interesting. So I'm curious, you're a gastroenterologist. You have an impressive resume, Yale and Columbia, and I'm wondering how you got into this, but you know, the gut health thing, because
yeah. It
is, oh, it's not alternative, but it's not allopathic necessarily. Kind of explain where you're coming from and why you are where you are now.
Absolutely, Lynn. So I was trained at wonderful institutions, but sort of conventional, and I was a conventional doctor. I still wear a white coat. I have a prescription pad. I try not to whip it out too much. The change really began for me, I would say, about 12 or so years ago, maybe a little bit more. I joined the faculty at Georgetown in 1997, and I kind of, believe it or not, they'd not had a woman on the gastroenterology faculty before then, and gastroenterology is still a field where a lot of the patients are female. So I was very busy very quickly, just by virtue of my gender. And a lot of the women I saw wanted to know not just what they had, but why. You know, why do I have Crohn's? Why do I have irritable bowel syndrome? What can I do about it? And it's certainly not something that's gender specific. My male patients wanted to know also. But I realized how lacking my medical education was. I knew how to do really complicated procedures, and I knew how to prescribe complex medication, but I didn't know how to answer that basic question of why. And I'm so grateful to the hundreds of patients I've seen over the years who have sort of allowed me to experiment on them in terms of their diet and lifestyle, and who have shared the results of their experimentation. So I, within my chosen area of expertise of Crohn's and ulcerative colitis, I started seeing patients who would tell me that they had changed their diet and they were off their medication. And in the beginning, I really didn't believe them, quite frankly. I thought, this isn't possible for you to be in remission and not on any medication. And I had the advantage, being a gastroenterologist, I was actually in their gut with my colonoscope looking, and I could see that things had healed. And I was incredulous in the beginning because, I mean, this was magical thinking as far as I was concerned 12 or 13 or 15 years ago, that you could heal inflammation by changing the diet. And it was really through taking care of many of these wonderful patients over the years that I realized that there was another paradigm for healing inflammation and that this was possible. And, you know, in my practice now, this is what we specialize in. We specialize in getting patients off of steroids and biologics and other immune-suppressing medications that work but come at a cost that can cause tremendous problems in the body with infection and cancer and so on. And we do that primarily through careful analysis of the microbiome, changing the diet, lifestyle changes, using robust probiotics, and it's just incredibly rewarding because, again, I got to that point in my practice where I decided I didn't want to prescribe medications that I myself wouldn't be willing to take, and I wanted to look for other ways of treating disease that weren't going to be creating illness in their wake. I think we're going to look back at this time in medicine and we're going to really think, gosh, what were we doing? You know, we're removing organs for no reason a lot of the time. We're using drugs to treat illness that themselves create illness. We're not paying attention to how people live. And we have to change because otherwise we're going to be very sick and not be around for very much longer.
Robin, I think people who are listening to this right now might have this thought occurring or this question popping into their mind. And I'm thinking, and there are two sides to it. What does a healthy microbiome look like or feel like or present as? And what does an unhealthy one present as? And maybe you could explain, you know, and kind of using some simple example, what people might, how they might do a self-analysis.
Sure. Well, Tim, it's really the million-dollar question, and it's actually the $300 million question. I think that's about the budget that NIH has allocated to the Human Microbiome Project, where they're trying to figure that out. But the, asking what a normal microbiome looks like is kind of like asking what a normal woman looks like. So we have a sense of what an unhealthy woman looks like, but a healthy woman comes in lots of different sizes, shapes, and colors. A healthy woman could be 5'2" or 5'11". She could be 100 pounds or 180 pounds. So we have a better sense of what a disordered microbiome looks like. And remember that the microbiome is adapted for where you live and your particular set of circumstances. So the microbiome of somebody in the Amazon is going to look very different from the microbiome of somebody in Park City, Utah, because it's adapted for your environment. But that being said, we know that species diversity is very important. We want to see a microbiome that has a lot of different species reflected. So high diversity is good, kind of like an SAT score. Low diversity is bad, kind of like an SAT score. And that's usually given as a percentile. We also look at the ratio of the four big phyla or families of bacteria in the gut, and those are Firmicutes, Bacteroidetes, Proteobacteria, and Actinobacteria. And we look at the ratio. When we see very high Firmicutes, that is often cause for concern, or if we see very high Proteo. So we want the ratios to be in this particular pattern. Typically, in the old days, a decade or so ago, to look at what was going on with the microbiome, we had to get a sample of stool and culture it out and kind of sit by the petri dish waiting for things to grow. Now we do what's called next-generation DNA sequencing, and there's a company in California called Ubiome that does this very well, and they are very interested in empowering the citizen scientists, so you don't have to come to me to get your microbiome analyzed or at least studied. You might need to, you might need some help with the interpretation, but you can get a kit from them or from our website, and you swab the toilet paper after bowel movement. You send it in a little pre-packaged kit, and they do this DNA sequencing and analyze your microbiome and send you back the results. As I said, the interpretation you might need some help with, but it's a great way to look at your microbiome, to come back again if you've had a significant dietary change, maybe you're going plant-based, or maybe you've had the misfortune of being on antibiotics and you want to see what changes have resulted. And again, I'm all for empowering citizen scientists as we embark on this grand experiment to figure out what a healthy microbiome looks like. We know that there are differences there. Microbial signatures, if you will, for different diseases. So diseases like Crohn's disease and even obesity has a microbial signature in terms of the diversity and some species that are overrepresented and others that are underrepresented. So we're all learning together about what this looks like. And I actually encourage people to do microbiome analysis because we're all contributing to the body of knowledge. It helps us to figure out what's healthy and what's unhealthy.
So we know, Robin, that naturopathic doctors probably could help us with this interpretation if we sent off the sample, right? But you know, is your average gastroenterologist doing this sort of work?
You know, unfortunately, they're not. And unfortunately, the average naturopath isn't necessarily either. I mean, they're doing other types of stool analysis, but it's really an emerging field. And there are few of us in it. We're hoping more and more. And I do think that there has been a lot of interest from the naturopathic community. I think the allopathic community, at least of gastroenterologists, still seems to be spending a lot of time doing endoscopy and colonoscopy and maybe not as interested in what's going on a microscopic level. Mm-hmm. But the science is really moving fast. When I started doing the research for this book a few years ago, there was one or two articles a month on the microbiome. Now there's several a day in multiple different fields, not just in gastroenterology, but in diabetes and autism, Parkinson's, heart disease, Alzheimer's. There's so many studies that are, you know, so much data out there. So it's a terrific time. And I just like to remind people that this is an incredible message of optimism and hope. Yeah. Because unlike our genes, which are somewhat static and you get what you get and you don't get upset, our microbes are changing all the time. The microbes that we wake up with tomorrow are different from the ones we went to bed with tonight. And if we drink a green smoothie in the morning, they're really different. I mean, there are things that we can actively do to affect change. I've seen it with so many of my patients in the practice. And, you know, it's a way for us to really be architects of our own health in some very profound ways.
You have no idea how happy you just made Tim. He's a green smoothie addict.
Yay, Tim! Live dirty!
3.5 years, Robin, every morning.
That, and I bet, when was the last time you had a bad flu?
It's been a long time. I rarely get
it's
sick.
It's been a while.
Yeah, no, I rarely ever get sick. And yeah, I think I've gone probably for a couple of years at a time without getting a significant illness.
Well, I don't think it's an accident. Keep on rocking those green smoothies. Highly recommend them.
We were just wondering if perhaps he should put spinach in his smoothie that hasn't been washed instead of
yes.
the thrice washed.
Yes, depending on where it's been grown. I mean, you know, if it's grown somewhere you can vouch for it, it's not a bad idea. Just a little light rinse, absolutely.
I'm all about the little light rinse when you know where it comes from, but the stuff I get, it's hard to say where it comes from. And it is hermetically sealed. It's been homogenized and hermetically sealed.
Well, maybe it's time for a little spinach garden
yeah,
closer to home.
I get that occasionally, but it's rare.
Oh, good idea. So before we let you go, Dr. Chutkan, I wanted to ask you to give me that source again. If someone was thinking, oh, I am going to send in a fecal sample, it was Ubiome.
Ubiome.com, or you can also get it on our website, gutbliss.com, GUTBLISS.com.
Okay, excellent. Such an
There's
interesting...
There's also the Human Gut Project. The Human Gut Project also does microbiome analysis, too, and that's a nonprofit, so that's a great place to get your microbiome analyzed also.
Okay, wonderful. It's the Microbiome Solution, a radical new way to heal your body from the inside out. Dr. Robin Chutkan, it's been a pleasure to speak with you. What interesting information.
Thank you so much for having me. It was my pleasure.
All right. Take care.
Thanks for listening to The Mountain Life. We'll be right back.
Josh here, owner of Este Pizza, and delighted to support KPCW. Located at 1781 Sidewinder Drive in Prospector, Este Pizzeria offers New York-style pizza with hand-tossed dough, homemade sauces, as well as vegan and gluten-free items. Open daily for lunch and dinner. 435-731-8970 or estepizzaco.com.
Hi, this is Dr. Juliana Miller from Miller Orthodontics, a proud supporter of The Local View with Randy Barton. With a combined 45 years of orthodontic experience, my husband and I are now raising our family and working full-time in the Park City community. There are so many reasons to smile in Park City. More information at m2ortho.com.
This is Dr. Phil Davidson of Davidson Orthopedics, KPCW supporter, providing personalized knee and shoulder care, focusing on cartilage restoration and joint resurfacing, and now incorporating stem cell therapy. More information on our website at davidsonorthopedics.com.
Well, that's the show. I'd like to thank our underwriters, The doctors at the Park City Specialty Clinic, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties, San Francisco Design, Park Meadows Country Club, Park City Mountain, and Chateau Recovery. You're listening to KPCW Park City.
From NPR, looking at the forecast, not a cloud in sight for the next 5 days, with highs in the upper 60s.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by Park City Bike Demos, Kearns Boulevard next to Adolph's, parkcitybikedemos.com. Long, Reimer, Weiniger, Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-Law.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
You're listening to KPCW Park City. NPR News coming up next, and then more music here on KPCW. Thanks for listening.